Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I will be talking to a whole host of different people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. And so, without further ado, to today's episode. Now, I'm not going to lie to you, but I'm more than a little nervous sitting here today. In fact, I feel like I'm back doing my oral exams in the Leaving Cert, sitting opposite someone infinitely better at doing what I am trying to do and who makes a living teaching other people how to do it. It's my pleasure to talk to Mick O'Keefe. Mick is Chief Executive of the Irish arm of the global CEO advisory firm Teneo. He is a former Managing Director of Pembroke Communications and CEO of PSG, which he founded in 2014 following the merger of Slattery Communications and Pembroke Communications. Mick leads the Teneo consultancy, and he's responsible for company strategy and development, as well as global integration. He oversees the growth of the corporate strategy and sponsorship businesses within Teneo PSG. He's deeply involved in reputation management, CEO advisory, issues management, and media training for senior C-suite clients, politicians, and sports stars. Mick has a proven track record in developing successful commercial strategies for sporting and non-sporting organisations. He's also negotiated some of the biggest sponsorship deals in Ireland in recent years. But more importantly than all of that, Mick has represented the Republic of Ireland in football at underage and universities level, and Dublin in GAA at all levels, including senior. He's currently a member of the Dublin football over 40s team. Mick, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you.
A long CV there. But look, before
nothing
we delve
like
in,
a PR person to write their own CV.
Before we delve into the history, and while I might have covered some of the intro, perhaps you could give us some insight into the various activities at Teneo. Most people probably just see Teneo on Shane Lowry's arm and wonder, who the hell are they?
Yeah, so Teneo was founded in 2011, and it's a global CEO advisory firm is the position of the company. In Ireland, we've 90 people now. Primarily at its heart was corporate communications, financial communications, crisis management, what you would expect from a good corporate communications consultancy. Through acquisition and diversification, it now offers management consulting. We have a part of the business called Teneo Performance, run by Liam Sheedy, which is very much around executive coaching, leadership development. Recently launched a financial advisory business, which looks at restructuring, liquidations, and also some other financial advisory services. And we have an executive search arm as well. So very much diversified from where it would have come from a full-service communications company. So, and working with a lot of the multinationals here, but also a lot of the large indigenous Irish companies as well.
It's a good mix of businesses there.
Yeah, it's great. And look, some parts of the business are in their infancy. Some parts are quite mature. I think being part of the international network, you get to pull on the kind of expertise in other markets too. And I suppose Ireland is a small market when it comes to consulting and it comes to comms. So being able to work on European briefs or working with US multinationals with a pan-European remit or with our UK colleagues, I suppose it's interesting work and it's diverse. But secondly, the fee levels tend to be higher and bigger for work like that.
Okay. So as I said in the intro, you set up the business, your own business, Pembroke Communications. Then you merge it with Slattery, and then you ultimately sell it to Teneo. But I'm always intrigued about that decision for certain people who set up business and sell them on. They can either take the money and go off and do something else themselves, or they stay on and within the business that's bought them over and drive that business on. So can you give some insight into that?
Yeah, and I suppose the Pembroke Communications was a kind of a smallish PR company, when a better way in old man's language, and we ended up being part of the Publicis Group, which was an advertising agency. So that was an interesting dynamic, running a communications firm as part of a big creative agency. Mm-hmm. That was then bought out in 2014, and we merged with Slattery Communications. So my wife, Kelly, and I worked together in Pembroke, and then she was working for her father's company, and then we got married in 2012, and he kind of said, well, look, would you like to run the family business?
It was a dual
here?
Merger.
So, well,
it?
It was more than it was a triple merger. So he said, look, you know, Slattery Communications here, would you, you know, we're all in the same family now. We shouldn't be competing against each other. And Pembroke, I suppose, at that point was an up and coming kind of agile PR consultancy. And then the merger made a lot of sense because we both had at the time 20 people, and as I said, I always dreamed of working with my wife and father-in-law ever since I was 16. And so we ended up merging the companies in 2014, which is probably the biggest move of all in my career, taking what I suppose I had developed and grown in Pembroke and had a lot of sense of kind of ownership of, and merging with Slattery's, which then kind of moving from an ad agency, multinational environment into what was essentially a private family independent business. And both with very different challenges. And to be fair to my father-in-law, Pádraig Slattery, was extraordinarily generous with his time. And also he took the role of chair and I took the role of CEO. And we ended up having an opportunity, which doesn't happen a lot in business, where you can kind of start from scratch. You know, you're in a business and you're, you know, there's good things and bad things about the business. But sometimes when a merger happens, get an opportunity to kind of break it down and build it back up. And we set up a consultancy that had four very distinct business units. One was so we could specialise and hire people with deep specialism. The other one was in a small market, been able to hold what people would say are conflict clients or people from within the same sector. So we had a brand consultancy, we had a digital consultancy, which was kind of ahead of its time, which was moving communications into creating content and things like what you're doing here yourself around podcasting and video, and social media was really only beginning to kick off at that point. Corporate communications, which is all the things we discussed earlier, and sport, which had been a long heritage of both Slattery's and Pembroke. And Pádraig had brought a deep rugby golf expertise and a lot of sponsorship nous, and we had a lot of GAA and also rugby as well. So that kind of created Ireland's largest sports practice as well, which was quite an interesting dynamic. So that kind of went gangbusters in 2014. You know, maybe we were lucky we caught the market at the right time, but I think people liked what we were doing. It was slightly different and fresher looking than what others were doing. So won a lot of business, and you know, within 2 years kind of went from, you know, 2 + 2 didn't equal 2 anymore, kind of 2 + 2 was 7. And that happened because we had a bit of scale. But to get to your point around Teneo, the conversation started with Teneo in 2016. Teneo, very fast paced, dynamic, you know, New York headquartered company. I think the conversation started in May and was finished by the end of June. So whereas these things can take years when you get into due diligence and all that kind of stuff that happens. But to answer your point, you know, it's a big sea change when you go from entrepreneur, family business, you know, when you run a family business or you're part of running a family business, you never question your purpose, right? You never get up in the morning and go, what am I doing here today? You know what you're there for. Everything's on the line. You're out to go. When you're acquired by a big global consultancy, I think people either go one of two ways. One is they go, that's it. I do my 3 to 5 years and I check out. I suppose when I and the company joined Teneo, one, I had a sense of loyalty to my clients, and you don't just walk away from clients you've had for 10 and 15 years. I obviously had a sense of loyalty to my people, want a better way of saying it. And I think I looked at Teneo and went, right, I actually don't fully understand everything here and I need to get my head around it. And it was intellectually challenging for me to understand the world of consulting, to understand the world of financial advisory. You know, that wouldn't have been necessarily my home where I started. So as long as I was being challenged and as long as I was learning and I felt developing, I didn't feel a need to exit, want a better way of saying it. And I've enjoyed it. It hasn't been out without its challenges, like everything. But I think very much left to your own devices. You know, there's a sense of direction, there's a strategy, obviously, but a lot
and
of...
And a huge network to draw on if you need it.
Absolutely, and a lot of trust put in the leadership of the local markets. Now, a lot of the other CEOs that were acquired have since exited for various reasons. Some of them probably had a different life and career cycle to where I was at. But no, it's really enjoyable. The company is growing and we're attracting really good people, which kind of what I suppose turns me on, what a better way of saying it is, working with smart people, you know, and I suppose like anything in Davie or other places, it's problem solving a lot of the time. And once you're in that space, I think that keeps you motivated and keeps you pushing on.
And in general, how did your client base greet the new ownership?
Yeah, and that's a really good question. I suppose when I was in Pembroke, I suppose we positioned ourselves as, you know, young, dynamic. Ring us at 12 o'clock on a Sunday, we'll be there, you know, small, you know, and do whatever.
Agile.
Standing on our head, yeah, standing on our head for you. And very much kind of people who worked with us probably saw us as that kind of dynamic upstart. And then there was a big sea change then into the PSG days where we kind of became probably market leader or one of the market leaders. So that was a slightly different proposition. And, you know, some clients had left one company to go to the other and there was a little bit of that. But actually the clients, I think, what I found were, and it just sounds cliche, but people deal with people and the relationships are strong. And if the client was in a good place going into the merger or the acquisition, there was never an issue. If the client was wobbly and there were underlying issues, well, then there was an issue,
it
right?
Festered, yeah.
Yeah, and people use that as an excuse to renegotiate or whatever. And we didn't have much of that, to be fair. All our clients moved with us into the PSG days and on the Slattery side too. And in fact, the customer promise of you'll get more, there's more deeper expertise, it's a bigger company. And then with Teneo, what I found is that people that I'd worked with for 9 and 10 years, A, first of all, and a lot of Irish people say Irish people are, you know, begrudging or whatever, I didn't find that at all. I actually found people were really happy that there was a sale of the company and that the owner drivers of the company were merging with a big global consultancy. There was a different look and feel to Teneo than perhaps with the independent family business. But again, similarly, I think people trusted us. And we also had access to people like, you know, William Hague and George Mitchell. And, you know, when you're rolling out the senior advisors from the global network and showing maybe behind the curtain the scale and breadth and connectivity, I think a lot of the senior clients that we dealt with welcomed that. Yeah. And now, you know, we're in a very good place because we can go in with a client that may have traditionally been a, you know, a sports client, for argument's sake, and now we're doing organisational design work for them. or sometimes...
Yeah, there's lots of different arrows in the quiver.
Absolutely.
Now,
yeah. And, you know, people want sometimes to use different suppliers or different partners for different things. But definitely, I found, it's a lesson for me, is I think people were extremely generous and happy for you. And I think we're always willing to stick with people that they felt would do a good job and were good, honest people to work with. And that's kind of translated into the new company as well. And excuse me, I think with Teneo, you know, a lot of the culture of the Irish part of the business remained from the PSG days, albeit we layered in the global consultancy culture as well.
You raise an interesting point because it's one I often think about is, and particularly when, you know, so much of your business, as I said, is relationship based, you know, can a global company, in your opinion, really have just one corporate culture when you have so many offices around the world and it's come from so many different places in terms of lots of mergers and acquisitions along the way?
I think, look, the short answer is probably no. And I maybe get shot for saying that, but I think what you can have is a consistent kind of, you know, vision as a company. So we want to be the best CEO advisory firm in our market, right? And everyone can strive to that. But what's good for Germany is not the same for what's good for Dubai, right? Yeah. And what's good for Dubai is not the same for Hong Kong and Dublin and everything else. So, excuse me, what I found was that the Teneo culture actually changed through acquisitions. So if you buy a 300-person practice in London and you're a 1,000-person firm, obviously you need to integrate that culture. But I think there should be consistent behaviours and consistent kind
almost
of values.
Yeah.
That everyone has to abide by. And I suppose from a client perspective, you want to be doing high-value strategic work. That's whatever that manifests itself like in Belfast versus Birmingham. That's up to the local market people to work out. But I think around values and behaviours and look and feel, there needs to be consistency. But I don't think you can have one, you know, culture that just goes the whole way through, a firm from top to bottom that's exactly the same in every market. And you have to be able to change your culture and move And be agile with
it. It's a local business at the end of the day. Maybe a global company, but it's a local business that people are dealing with companies at a local level.
Well, it is. And you know, like we have to be able to deal with the big multinational who's investing billions in Ireland, and then at the same time deal with our client of 20 years, Dublin Zoo. And we have a director in there who's concerned about, you know, conservation and visitor numbers. And at the same time, we have a fella down the road who's trying to build a manufacturing site, you know. Yeah. But you're right, it's relationships, and the culture needs to be translated to work locally.
Yeah. How much of your time is spent, if you will, on the shop floor as opposed to up in the management office?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. So I started my PR life or communications life with Bill O'Hurley a million years ago, and Bill had an obsession with being on the TV, and I remember saying to him, you know, you don't need to be on the TV, you know, you've got your business. He said, well, if you're not on the TV, you're not relevant, you know. Yeah. And I always felt that, you know, and not that I'm in pubs a lot of the time, but you know, if you walk into a bar or a hotel or a restaurant and the proprietor's not there, you know, is there a bit of slippage? Do people want to see the fella at the door? You know, and I'm very much of the view that the CEO is not just the manager of the business. I think you have to keep an eye in on the business. So I would say at least 50% of my time is working with clients or business development. Mm-hmm. And 50% of the time is running the business. I think I've been helped because eventually we got to a scale where I could actually justify a COO, which took a world. If I could do that 10 years ago, I was doing, like, I remember in Pembroke when we 20 people, you're doing contracts. I'm sure half of them aren't legally, you know. You're doing client contracts, you're dealing with every client, you're on every new business pitch, you know, you're dealing with projections, you know. Yeah. But it's
and HR issues and everything else.
But it's a good point. I think oftentimes in professional services, you know, like the best accountant doesn't make the best CEO, you know, or the best managing partner or whatever. I think in our case, you have to keep abreast of trends, because in our world, the consulting world, and if you take communications as part of that, you know, back in the day, communications was media office, in and out, press releases, photo calls, you know, crisis management, media training, kind of box of tricks. Now a communications company is expected to do ESG strategy, CSR strategy, government engagement, you know, lobbying,
stakeholder engagement,
stakeholder management, internal communications. Like, the breadth of it is so much. But if you sat there trying to manage the firm, I think you'd probably lose touch with the actual skill set. So I have a mini paranoia about having to get involved. So I have my own suite of clients, and then I try and keep across as many clients as I can from a kind of a helicopter. Yeah, view. You can't be in everything, and you have to trust your senior people to do their job. But in
that's
saying
what
that,
you're paying them for.
Well, absolutely. But in saying that, we would every week run through our clients top to bottom, and everybody would have a superficial knowledge of what's happening, obviously in case somebody decides to leave and you haven't, you know, if the fog is what's happened with your clients. So,
and do you think that then is a key element of effective management within that industry? Because it can't be applied to every industry, right? That type of yeah, management. But do you think within the communications and the broader advisory business that you do, that is a key element of effective management?
Yeah, and I suppose I never had anybody write a job spec for me, so I actually write my own job spec every year, right? And I sit down and I go, this is what I think I should be doing. And I kind of sense check it, and I look at how I weight my time, because obviously a lot of consultancies work from a time perspective. I challenge myself around how much of my role should be, let's call it, presidential, where you're out meeting people, dinners, speaking at things, you know, doing media work, and that kind of thing.
On podcasts.
yes. And I think there's a part of your role is that. I think, but you can't do that all day, every day either. You know, how much of my role should be looking for hiring better people to come into the company, or the best people around town to come into the company? How part of my role should be looking at what company should we be looking to acquire in the market? So that time I'm spending in the belly of a data breach crisis for a client, should I be better spent doing something else? I think it's about balance, you know. And, you know, you get to the end of the week without sounding cliche, and I kind of go, well, how did I do this week? And you're kind of like, oh, well, maybe 7, 8 out of 10. Maybe I could have done this better, maybe I could have done that better. You do need to keep a strategic view.
Yeah.
I think being part of a global consultancy, sometimes you have your own business plan, when a better way of saying it, but sometimes the corporate strategy is directed,
yeah.
And you have to look at that and translate that similar to the culture piece and maybe tweak it to suit your local market. So one example very quickly is Teneo has always called itself the CEO advisory company, right? And it's a lovely proposition and it's very true.
Yeah.
And particularly in the US where you have very powerful chief executives.
Yeah.
Whereas in Ireland and maybe Europe, you know, you have to think more about C-suite rather than just CEO, because the chief people officer, it becomes quite, the CFO becomes very influential. Now there's chief sustainability officers, you know, so you have to be able to tweak the strategy. So very long-winded answer to your question is, I try and keep it that at least 50% of my time is in the trenches, on a better way of saying it.
You mentioned a point in there about hiring from outside or training up from inside. Where are you on the mix?
We have had a really good track record of bringing in people at intern level and training them up, and they're now what we call managing director in our world, which is basically you're at the top table. You'd probably, in other legal firms, or what they call a partner, right? They either run a practice or they're at a senior level. So, you know, 3 or 4 of our 10, 11 MDs would have come from that, which is a big, big percentage. Mm. However, I do think you run the risk of everyone's kind of the same, and you know, you don't need 10 mini mix running around, you know.
Gary McGann says that you run the risk of groupthink, all just getting
100%, and you all come from the same mindset, the same ways of working, you know. And like I have my flaws, and you know, you look around at people that I've trained, when a better way of saying it, and they have similar flaws,
characteristics, let's call them
characteristics. And I think it's good to have a mix, and I think where we've been lucky is through diversification an acquisition. So we brought in a boutique firm from the southwest of Ireland. We brought in Cotinos, which was a management consulting practice which specialised in organisational high performance. We bring in people with completely different mindsets and ways of working, culturally, albeit they're similar to you. But I think it's important to have a combination. But I've been a big believer in ongoing professional development. Get young, bright people in, train them up, give them really good training. You know, they might hate you for it at the time, but what gives me a lot of pleasure sometimes is, and I sound like an awful saying this now, but I look around town and I see 20 people that work for us that are now running either their head of corporate affairs or managing directors or whatever in big companies around town. You know, everything from Microsoft to the GPA to Leinster Rugby, you know, you know, Pfizer, like loads of different places. And it's great. And it gives me loads of, that makes me happy that these people have gone on and have really good careers outside Teneo, but also we fellas within and ladies within our place now who are there 10, 12, 13 years. I know have been stimulated and are staying within the firm. And I think some of that is because the company has changed so much. You know, you haven't worked in the same job for 10 years. You've actually worked for 3 different companies, albeit the same company.
Yeah, yeah. Do you obsess about the small things?
Yeah, probably. I get bogged down in, like, little things annoy me. So I shouldn't say that, but they do. Like, small detail annoys me. You know, we have a saying around excellence every one, every time, which I actually think was borrowed from Joe Schmidt, which is, you know, if something leaves the company, like if someone sent out something to a client, a document, and there was mistakes in it, that would drive me bananas, right? Now, that's not a small thing. That's quite a big thing, right?
Yeah.
You know, little things, you know, sloppy behaviours. But, like, if someone came into me, which they did yesterday, and said, look, we just put 2 months into this pitch, didn't win it. That's gone in 5 seconds from my mind. I've moved on. Somebody comes in and says they're leaving, I'm kind of moving on to the solution. So big things don't faze me, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, which are challenges that come your way. Little things annoy me. So
yeah, I'm a bit the same myself.
If that's
yeah. Yeah. Switching tack a little bit, I mentioned in the intro, sports sponsorship is a huge thing within the business, and I'm always intrigued about how you put the right person with the right brand, and I kind of think of there's obvious ones that are very easy, you know, like if Steph Curry and Under Armour come together for a pair of basketball boots, everybody goes, well, that's kind of obvious, right?
Yeah.
But you know, when you look at sports people or just, you know, talent in general, and putting them with you know, brands. How do you go about kind of going, actually, do you know what? Those two fit together. Where I'd be sitting on the outside kind of going, you know, well, we go back to the age of why is Teneo and Shane Lowry, you know, yeah. That, it's things like that you don't necessarily see, and it can't be just about money because it's not in either interest.
No, and it looks, it's a really good question. So we have a sports practice that goes back 3 decades now between all the different various kind of heritage companies. It's about 10% of our business, but it punches way above its weight in terms of profile. Mm. Because the work that you do, if you're negotiating a front-of-jersey sponsorship for the Irish rugby team or the Dublin GA team, or it's high-profile work. Yeah. Now, it's a smallish market, and we have to kind of export our expertise into other markets. To take your direct question, so, you know, we tried to put a bit of science behind this. I don't know if you've seen the Michael Jordan thing, where some of it is gut, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, we went back and we did a kind of a criterion checklist, because we get companies come to us all the time and say, you know, we're looking for a brand ambassador, or sometimes the chief executive has met this person. Do you think they're right?
Right. Yeah.
which often happens, or used to happen, I should say. So we looked at who works and why do they work. And there's a couple of criteria that really help. And if you have a criteria, well, then you can kind of work your way back. So for me, one of the best ever brand ambassador things ever done was Roy Keane and the Guide Dogs, right? Mm. And I know it's charity, but if you think about it, he's a genuine passion. There's a credibility in it. It's a long-term partnership, and it gets buckets of notice, right? And it works really, really well. So if you take that as a starting principle in terms of, is there credibility in it? And people will look through it and they'll see that there's not. I think in the big brand, those big sports brands that are looking for the edge and are looking to, or even alcohol brands, which used to do it back in the day as well, or car too, what they're trying to do is match up brand values, attributes with the other, or take the brand values and attributes of the sports star, and obviously to give them a different image and appeal to a different audience. So you often find with alcohol, back in the day, they would have worked with kind of hip hop or DJs or whatever, because they're trying to, they may have lost a certain young audience to a different kind of a drink, and they're trying to engage with that particular audience. So there is an element of the research goes in, there's an insight that says we can't deal with these kind of people, so we need to target that kind of audience, young, I mean, obviously over 18. But when it comes to things like the Adidas, Nike, Under Armour, you know, I'd actually worked with Under Armour 100 years ago when they first came into the Irish market, and it's fascinating the amount of time they put into picking the person okay. that they deal with. An amazing brand as well at the time. So I think it has to be similar attributes, it has to be credible, it should be long term if it can be, and then what we do now, because we've a sports practice in a corporate shop, we put a risk lens across it too. So, you know, the amount of times people go in and they realise that somebody tweeted something way back when, which was deemed to be either racist or, you know, sectarian or whatever, or they have some kind of issue in the past, and it blows up. Or also, better again, what's their likelihood that this is going to end in tears somewhere down the line as well? So you have to, I think, put a risk kind of lens on this stuff too. So,
and like, it's funny you mentioned that, because obviously we've seen two big brands come a cropper a bit, or have issues this year. We obviously had Adidas and Kanye West, and now we've had Diageo and Kanye West. And from the brand owner's perspective, at what point do you and is it really as quantitative as the value of destruction to our brand versus the immediate cost? It means that we do it now and we don't wait because it's going to be too detrimental.
No, and I think that's a really good point. I think there comes a time where you have to stick by your asset or star through thick and thin. And the Tiger Woods crises over the year was quite interesting to see who exited and who stayed. And Wayne Rooney had his issues, David Beckham had his issues. Oftentimes the brand, or the, like, whether it was Adidas at the time with Beckham, it kind of suited their image a little bit. There was kind of a bit of the bad boy kind of worked for them at that time. I think ultimately what it comes down to is, and these are big corporations, you know, and I think it comes down to value. I think if value has been impacted, I think then that's when the conversation starts to hit, where they realise actually people aren't going to buy my shoes now because this guy has said something that's racist, or this person has done something. It's very clean cut if it's a big misdemeanor. I think where it's nuanced,
or subjective in any way. Yeah.
Well, it also works the other way. So, you know, where you have a brand ambassador, and this happened in tennis as well, if there's a big corporate scandal and people go, okay, well, can I still be associated with this brand? And we've seen that in this market, and we've seen it in other markets where people have brand ambassadors. And oftentimes they'll say, well, look, that's not my business. And obviously there's a financial element to this as well. But sometimes they'll say, well, look, there are other people within this organisation. This was a particular moment in time. And I feel this company's been loyal to me, so I will stick with them through thick and thin. But, you know, if you take, you know, what back then Dieselgate or something that is a big corporate cultural...
The global financial crisis. So many sports people were sponsored by financial institutions.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, so I think brand ambassadors and sports people need to be careful. Now, it's easier when you're Rory McIlroy, who can take a decision and, you know, it's not necessarily the mortgage isn't on the line, don't think. But there are other people who probably are very reliant on the sponsorship money and have a difficult decision to make as well.
Yeah.
On that point, I remember many years ago when Dublin first won their first All-Ireland, not their first one ever, obviously, but the first was felt like the first one ever in 2011. One of the Dublin players came to me and he was like, I just need a bit of help. And I said, okay, you know, and he said, I've been asked to open a fast food restaurant up around where my club is. And I said, all right. He said, what are they offering you? He said, okay, that sounds good. I said, are you going to do it? And he said, I don't think so. I said, why? And he said, well, actually, I have this ambition down the line to set up gyms and to get into healthy eating. And I've seen at first hand in my community what, you know, somewhat some of these fast food outlets do. And I said, I don't even going to do it. And I said, well, do you know what? There's a fellow who knows exactly.
Great foresight. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And you know, I'd say in a very rare minority of people who made a long-term strategic decision while there was money sitting in front of him. He didn't have a lot of money at the time, but has since subsequently built
what he wanted to build.
Yeah. And I thought, geez, there's a guy now who really knows his mind.
Because that's a real case of your history catching up on you then in half a dozen years' time, you know?
Absolutely. Now, look, you know, you can do endorsement deals and a lot of the time people have, you know, we've dealt with sports stars and they turn up and they say, what am I doing today? You know, right, okay. but actually, you know, I think those days to turn up for the photo call and throwing the tins of paint around or whatever, you know, are gone. I think young athletes are smart. I think they understand their brand. I think they're getting better advised by their, whether it's their Arupas or the GPAs maybe older players in the panels and stuff like that. And I think that's much better. And I think it helps brands too because, you know, you want a fella who actually has a genuine interest in what you're doing as opposed to just turning up and jumping into photo call to talk about the match.
Brand washing almost.
Exactly, yeah. I didn't use that term again, yeah.
Yeah. And we've covered a bit in it with this, but what's obviously and very pertinent given these times, approach to crisis management.
Yeah.
What are the three key things of crisis management? Go, you're doing your
here we go. There you are. Well, I did my homework earlier. So we would say it's predict, prepare, respond, right? Are your three key pillars, right? So, you know, this sounds really obvious, but if you're not doing scenario planning or looking at all the things that can go wrong. And I think a big mistake people make is they do a crisis simulation risk register and then they put it away in the cupboard for 3 years and then all of a sudden things like Twitter come along and other stuff and, you know, things like cybercrime, data breaches, like a lot of that. But I think you can predict to a point what we would say is buckets of issues. You can't ever predict the exact issue. So a massive reputational issue comes along, financial irregularity, you know, things like food safety, depending where you're in, data breaches, that kind of stuff. You can kind of have a look at those and you can predict what's going to happen. The preparation piece is interesting where some of the retailers are really good at this, where they go and they actually do simulations every couple of months, every 3 months, and they get in and they do it and they take a half day out and they go to a war room environment. And I think that would be something that you should do. Maybe not every 3 months, but certainly annually you should be updating your crisis plan. Also, when you're in your crisis plan, you have your crisis team, but your three guys might have left that were on your crisis team. And then you're looking for the phone call of the fella who's in charge, in charge of that particular issue, and then respond. And I think my big learning over all this and some crises are more difficult than others, right? Because some of them are deeply cultural and some of them are almost existential when it comes to a business, and we've all seen those. And I think it's how you respond to the crisis rather than sometimes the crisis itself is how you come out reputationally, right? So we would always advise clients, and this sounds really obvious too, where you can, and I know there's sometimes just legal boundaries around stuff that you can and can't say, but I think open, honest communication, think of the long-term reputation, not, geez, I hope they don't find this out, or kind of kick this one down the road, or how am I going to protect my job, you know? And oftentimes that 48 hours between the first statement that goes out, which is tone deaf, versus the second statement that goes out, you know, someone's reputation, career, etc., can be defined by how you deal with a crisis. Now, thankfully, most of the people we deal with take that advice. It's difficult because they pick up the paper the next day and it says they've made a mistake, and
it gets personal from their side.
It was their mistake. Okay. And but if you come out sometimes with the hands up, where I think it becomes really difficult is where it was a very deliberate attempt to mislead, and it points to a poor culture. And I think they're the ones that are really difficult to turn around. But they can be turned around, but it just takes time and it takes a lot of strong leadership.
And in terms of the response, how important is it that, you know, in the aftermath of something like that, the response is coming from one person, right? In terms of it might be the CEO, rather than a whole raft of different company representatives being rolled out and the message isn't kind of clear from one person.
Ideally, I think the CEO should front up in a time of a big crisis. Sometimes, if it's technical, the subject matter expert should also be there. What I wouldn't be doing is throwing the rank and file to in front of the cameras. The other question we get all the time is, you know, I don't have all the information. I don't think we should say anything. I think it's okay to say, we know something has happened. We actually don't have all the information. This is particularly relevant with complex cyber issues, but also financial irregularity, where you have to actually do further forensic examination of what went wrong. It's okay to come out and reply to say, we know something's happened. We don't have all the detail. And by the way, when we get all the detail, I'll come back to you. Rather than say nothing, because if you say nothing, what happens is they ring, you know,
20 other,
then you get the quotes and whatever. So, and it fills a vacuum and sometimes inaccurate. And once it's in there, it's hard to unravel. So you've been in control of the content. And sometimes these are very difficult things, like workplace tragedies. They can be product recalls, where you don't actually know exactly where everything is. But, you know, you have a duty of care a lot of the time to the general public and your stakeholders, investors and everybody else to do it right. And 99 times out of 100, if you behave in the right way, honestly, quickly, you come out of it with your reputation intact. And let's be honest, you're trying to protect value and you're trying to protect long-term reputation. If you get a kicking for 2 days because you made a mistake, so fine. Well, it's better than getting an article 3 months later saying that you were hiding information and actually something else happened on the back of that. And also, sorry, last point on that is you got to review that it's not isolated.
That it's not systemic in some way.
It's not systemic, but B, you know, if there was an explosion somewhere due to something faulty or whatever, bad example, but have you gone to make sure that everyone else is safe and you lock them down and you might lose your 3 days of
manufacturing of revenue, or whatever it is.
Exactly, but you're far better off doing that than there's a second one up the road then and you didn't do anything about it.
Just an aside, I suppose, the interesting thing with this year, we obviously had the BBC and Gary Lineker, we've had RTE, we've had ITV and Philip Schofield. It strikes me, and it's a bit funny, why are media companies so poor at message management?
I think a lot of the time, look, media love media stories, right? So there's that too, and there's usually a very intense and very public scrutiny, and we all have a sense of ownership of an RTE or in the UK of a BBC, so there tends to be an over indexing, I think, of interest. I would say a lot of the time these places are big, complex, unwieldy organisations where it's very difficult to get consistency. They're often quite siloed, and you find this in sport and you find this in media, where you have a commercial arm, you have a kind of a, let's call it a technical unit, which oftentimes in media that would be production and programming and whatnot. Then there's marketing and then there's the admin function. And oftentimes in different buildings.
And don't talk to each
different
other.
Different cultures, don't talk to each other. So I think a lot of the time this comes down to the corporate structure, how it's set up, unity at management level. And if you find with things like that, it's people haven't agreed on the best approach.
Fair enough. Who have you or who do you seek advice from? And I suppose, tally to that is, you know, what have you learned from other executives or companies along the way?
It's a very good question. I have a number of people that you would that I would talk to, obviously, friends who I trust, family. My dad, unfortunately, who I would have talked to, he got dementia there about 2011, 2012, so I can ask him for advice sometimes. Sometimes he makes more sense than other people. So he would have been somebody. My father-in-law is a very sound sounding board. Mm. But, you know, probably not enough. I probably feel, and this may be a weakness, that, you know, I was thrown in the deep end as an MD of Pembroke at 30 years of age and learned everything by mistake and kind of, probably a great way to learn, but quite a risky way to learn. I think I learned a huge amount from sport, and I know that sounds like a cliche, but I think a lot of ups and downs. You get dropped, you win matches, you lose matches. You know, you get injured. You learn to deal with triumph and disaster, I suppose, in equal measure. Yeah. And I think I learned a lot from some of my managers along the way. So as a kid, I was very lucky to have brilliant coaches. My older brother was really helpful to me. But then people like Joe Haverty, who played soccer for around 100 years ago, was a coach of mine in Stella Maris. And then Dave Billings was a coach of mine in UCD and Dublin under 21. Robbie Kelleher of former Davy Parish,
and
well,
my former boss
was a guy I really loved and loved working for. I think it was interesting. Managers who liked me, I tended to like, but I never knew more than my managers, which is another reason why I probably didn't play enough. But it's a long question. I read a lot about theory of management. I did have a mentor for a while, a guy called Cormac McCarthy, who suddenly passed away a few years ago. You may know he's former Ulster Bank and Paddy Power. He was a smashing fella, and I was introduced to him via my father-in-law under the kind of, I suppose, the idea was, as you made your very first question, how do you, now you're not in an independent family business, how do you work in a large organisation? Mm-hmm. Somebody just to have a sounding board with, very helpful at the start of COVID, a couple of very difficult times there. And then, you know, last text I got from him was something happened in our company, and he got a text from him saying, geez, we have to have a chat on Monday, and then he suddenly passed away as well. So at the moment I don't have particularly a mentor. I've a bunch of people I chat to. I have a couple of friends who are parents of friends of my kids who have businesses, and it's good. You have an informal chat with fellas like that. But I kind of probably try and figure things out myself, which maybe isn't always the right thing.
What's the hardest part of the job as a CEO?
I think anybody will probably say the same thing here. It's managing people. I think it's
your assets walk out the door every day.
Yeah, and I think bringing people on a journey. I think managing high performers, managing underperformers is a challenge. I don't think anybody, unless they're a masochist, likes having difficult conversations with people. I think if you're honest and have a good culture of open and transparent feedback, it shouldn't come as a surprise to people. Mm-hmm. But I think that is the most difficult thing. You know, clients have problems. You've problems with clients. You know, they tend to be ironed out. Mm-hmm. If you've a good long standing relationship. I think for me, I think getting my head around thinking long term rather than short term, I think is a challenge. I think you're trying to live quarter to quarter, get to the end of the year, you know. That's not really the way to live. You need to be thinking where you want to be in 3 and 5 years' time. I think that's probably a challenge too.
We have a tradition on this
podcast. Lovely.
And it's the last question one, right? So I don't know what this question is, but we'll open it up. Okay, it's good. I haven't asked you it already.
Lovely.
So that's always a good one. Right? What advice would you give your 25-year-old self?
Oh God. So I think I set out in life when I was 16 years of age. I played soccer in England for a while in Middlesbrough. I came back. All I wanted to be was a professional footballer. That was it. Played Ireland schools and schoolboys and that kind of thing. Fell into college, got a soccer scholarship. College was what I did when I was playing football, right? It wasn't really, never focused on the career. I think by luck, I ended up, because I didn't know what to do, football was all I wanted to do. I ended up being a journalist for a while. I actually worked in corporate FX in Anglo for a while. I was a teacher for a while. And then I went into communications. And I think, one, and people say this, you know, don't get stressed about the small stuff. My sister passed away. My dad, you know, has dementia. Those things are much more important than work, right? And your own personal happiness and all that kind of stuff is much more important. But I think from a career perspective, I think... you've critical years there, kind of 25 to 35, I think, where you got time to really try yourself at your job and at your work. I think they're the years to keep learning, push yourself, do extra professional development. But the one thing that stood to me in my career is having not just worked in one industry. By luck, I actually did a bit of time in RTE doing the politics stuff, writing stuff up on the wall. You know, I think the work in Anglo was really interesting. You got a sense of what a financial institution looks like, or not. And then the school teacher thing was fascinating. So having that diverse kind of background by pure luck, I think, was really interesting. So I think the one thing I'd say is enjoy it without sounding cliched. You know, you got your health. That's the most important thing. You know, if you're ambitious in your career, drive on, go for it, work all those hours. You know, they're really important years. And I think if you can try different things when you're young, I did a very open degree in master's, which was arts, and I loved it. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I loved it, and then I did a master's in European economics and politics and went to Brussels for a while and worked there for a while. Like, the more open your degree, the education you do, I think the better.
Don't go down the cul-de-sac too early.
I don't think so. I think keep your up. I know kids get all stressed about, I want to do this, and it should be, you know, they want to be an engineer at 17. No, you don't really, you know. Try as many things as possible. Work hard. And, you know, there's bigger things as well in life, you know.
That's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd like to thank my guest, Mick O'Keefe. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks, and we'll see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.